This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
I met Ann Bailey over 8 years ago when she came as a fellow to Harvard. She was a fireball of energy and passion for Jesus, telling about her newfound conviction that she was called to be part of a vanguard for God, not just watch pastors do the work of the gospel. Reconnecting with her today, after so many years, she is the same fireball. Anne has been a Christian her whole life, but came to a firmer footing when she was completing graduate school and writing her dissertation. She was baptized a month before getting her PhD, and in the process of getting baptized, laid her life before God in a way she never had before, asking, "What do you want me to do?" She was prepared for God to say, "You've indulged yourself enough with this academia for 8 years," and to send her to Mexico as a missionary. Instead, God gave her a very clear message: go deeper. That meant going for adjunct teaching jobs, the fellowship at Harvard, and faculty positions at Spelman and now SUNY Binghamton. It wasn't easy, but God has given her great favor each step of the way. If you had asked Anne in graduate school whether she could imagine the life she has now, the answer would have been a resounding no. In graduate school, Anne says she had one goal and one goal alone in life: to write a book. One book. Although she comes from a line of teachers, she didn't think of herself as an academic. She thought of herself as a writer. Well, she's now written that book. And God, praise God, has given her many more goals for her life. Among these is being a great mom to her 6-year-old son, writing 2 more books that she's under contract to write, and releasing godly activism along with her scholarship. Anne cares deeply about the places she writes about, in Africa and the Caribbean, from where she's from. And her activism has arisen from her teaching and scholarship. She has come to realize that God can do so many more things at the same time in her life, and that God's project is so much bigger than her goal of writing one book. Anne's favorite Christmas memory is her 6-year-old son still believing in Santa Claus, and her favorite drink is grape juice. Please welcome Anne Bailey.
Thank you very much, Kathy. What a beautiful introduction. And I found myself, as I was sitting here listening to the beautiful music that preceded our talk, thinking, every time I talk and speak, I should have a beautiful worship team like the one you had today. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I want to say that it's an honor and it's a privilege to be here, to join you, to share some of what God has laid on my heart for you today. I want to thank the conference organizers, certainly thank InterVarsity Fellowship, Alec Hill and John Boyd and all the others who have worked so wonderfully on this conference, the InterVarsity Press, which also is a co-sponsor. And I also want to particularly thank a few people in addition to Kathy: Jeff Barnson, Dr. Alice Brown Collins, Tony Warner, and Felicia Anderson. They are all from the Massachusetts and Georgia Fellowship, campus fellowships, respectively. I just have to thank them because they were part of introducing me to this wonderful organization almost 10 years ago, and their lives and commitment to Jesus and the work that is done on these campuses have inspired me and encouraged me. Thank you very much. I am a historian and a scholar activist, and I'm on leave this year from Binghamton University, State University of New York, working on 2 books. One book is called The Weeping Time: Anatomy of a Slave Auction, and it's about the largest slave auction in U.S. history, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that later on. And the second book is called The Myth of Goodness, and that's a book that I'm writing for InterVarsity Press, in fact. And the substance of my talk today is going to come from some of the chapters that I've been writing over the last few months or years, I should say. And so by introduction, I should say the topic of my talk is, what is God doing now? What is God doing now? The scriptural reference is from Zechariah 4:6, which we all know says, not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, said the Lord of hosts. Not by might, not by power, but by my spirit. The subject, of course, is human flourishing, and one purpose of our meeting here today and of the conference in general is to decide and answer, what is human flourishing and how does that come about, and are we flourishing? And I've been thinking about this question for months, and after a lot of rumination, I experienced a real shift of focus. And that focus was less on human flourishing and more on the concept of God flourishing. Or rather, that God is the beginning and the end of human flourishing. And I think this really picks up on some of the themes that we've heard throughout the conference, particularly this morning with Bishop Wright, when he talked about us as humans being made in God's image and reflecting his will and his purpose, that's our purpose as Christians, as people who are created by God, to reflect his will and his purpose. It's not about us. It really is not about us. I think that's probably the most enduring lesson that I learned once I got baptized, that this journey is not about me. And it's not about us. It really is about God. Jeff Van Duzer also very beautifully expounded on a similar theme when he talked about, what is God's original design? What was his original design? It doesn't say what was, you know, Adam and Eve's original design. That might have been interesting. But that wasn't really the question, right? The real question that he started with was, what was God's original design? In other words, what was God doing? And for our purposes, what is God doing? I think it's a really appropriate question if you think about it. And I'm hoping as I speak that, you know, we're all Christians here and that you even pray and ask in your own mind that you're asking the Lord, what are you doing, Lord? What are you doing? Keep searching and seeking the answer to that, because in these times of economic crisis, global warming, national and international insecurity, and we're talking about our own sense of national insecurity, but we're also talking about some of the hot spots in the world, like the Congo, the major crisis, millions of lives being lost in the Congo, Darfur. We're also talking about Israel, a place that, of course, is very near and dear to our hearts, and the conflicts and the crises there. This is a time where there's a lack of peace, where there's a lack of stability, where, in fact, in many ways, there's a lack of human flourishing from a human perspective. So I think it's appropriate to be asking the question, Lord, in these times, what are you doing from a spiritual perspective? We see so much that we don't like, and we see a lot of pain and suffering and probably more to come, frankly. But what are you doing, Lord? What are you doing now? That's more important than the things that we can see from an earthly perspective, not by might, human might, not by power, human power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. A refocus on God. I'm hoping that that's what this crisis or series of crises that we have endured and that we are enduring will help us to do, to really get back to the real question, which is God and what God is doing. Allow me to illustrate this point and this topic from two examples in my life. One is a professional example from my life as a historian, and the second is a more personal example from my own personal journey. I want to start with this whole question of some of the things that I do as a historian. I'm often asked, what do you do exactly? Sometimes by kind family members who are not quite sure, or just by others who really just don't know a lot about the field and innocently and honestly want to know about what the business of history is about. Well, I have been studying and learning, in my case, about African and African-American history and the Caribbean and South American history for over 20 years. I've had a particular focus on slavery and the slave trade and the legacy of both slavery, the slave trade, and also colonialism. And I spent a lot of time in Africa and Europe, the Caribbean, researching these things so that I can hopefully bring some light or some contribution to this discussion in classrooms around the country, if not the world. One of the books, my last book, was called, and is called, African Voices of the Atlantic Slave Trade, Beyond the Silence and the Shame. And this book that was published in 2005 and also in 2006 in the Caribbean, this book was really based on memories of the slave trade from the African perspective. I was very interested in what had been retained in Africa with respect to the legacy of slavery, what had been passed on from one family to the next, one generation to the next, and formerly in families, both those who were involved in the trade as traders and those who, of course, were largely victims of the trade. I was interested in capturing this material, and I did that in this book. And as a part of collecting this information, I also had to go to various archives. And one of the archives I found myself going to in the year 2000 was the North Bremen Missionary Society in Bremen, Germany. I don't know if we have anybody from Germany here, but Bremen is in the northern part of Germany. And these missionaries who once came to Ghana, the area of Africa where I was working and where I was collecting these memories of the slave trade, were really integral to the story. Because here I was learning from the Africans themselves about what was remembered regarding slavery, but I also knew that the missionaries were there at the same time. At the time that slave traffic was at its busiest, they were also there. They had come to Ghana in the 1840s to set up a mission station, a school, just as we know missionaries have done for hundreds of years and are still doing now. And they were a very interesting group. I was fascinated by them. And at this point, I was a newly baptized Christian. I have to tell you, I was very excited to be looking at missionary records as a Christian because I felt some connection to my subject. I also felt their courage. I admired the fact that many of them had gone to Africa and to Ghana in this case and died there. Within a couple of years, they died because of malaria or other fevers that they caught, other diseases. They sacrificed greatly to be there. And so I had a lot of respect for their journey, and I really thought that the journey of a missionary has never been easy. And those that we on whose shoulders we stand, I was excited to read a little bit of their story. Well, let me tell you a little bit about them and what I learned from that experience of looking at these records in Germany. For one thing, the North Bremen Missionary Society, they were a Presbyterian group. They were a little bit of a breakaway Presbyterian group, which believed in this idea that was called pietism. And pietism, broadly speaking, was just this desire to be holy or to seek a holy life. But it was not just a desire for personal holiness. They were really committed to spreading this notion of personal holiness all around the world. And so their missionary activities were based on that. Based in Germany, they went all the way to Ghana in southern Ghana and also in central Ghana to share this notion of personal holiness, to bring people to Christ. They also, as I mentioned before, they set up a mission station, they set up a school. And during this time in the 1840s and the 1850s, when the slave trade should have been over, it was technically abolished in 1807 by the British Parliament, it was really seeing and experiencing a resurgence. Traffic was going on an illegal level all around the world. European nations and North America were heavily involved in slave traffic, well up until the 1860s and 70s. And in the case of Brazil, they were still involved in slave traffic up until the 1890s. That's not that long ago, if you think about it. So these missionaries were in the midst of all of that, and they were watching slave traffic going on all around them. Well, what happened? They redeemed in a 10-year period, they bought back 150 slaves from slave traders in this area of southern Ghana. Now, some of you who may be involved in efforts to against slavery and the abolition of contemporary slavery may know of some movements that do exactly that. You buy the slave from the slave trader, and in that way you redeem or you free the slave. And I was very interested in that. I thought, my goodness, I mean, again, with funds that they raised in Germany, they actually bought the freedom of these young people, and they were mostly children that they bought. But with all of this said, and it sounds like a very interesting story, they complained that this part of Ghana was a hard soil for preaching. In other words, they had a scant harvest. They complained that they weren't able to really make many converts. Now, how many missionaries today can sometimes in some places that you go, you feel very frustrated? And they complain. All through the records, you see this. And one of the things that they said, which I found very funny, they said that the young people would come up to them at the mission station, and all they would say is, "Let me put on the trousers. Let me put on the trousers." That's all they would say. "Let me put on the trousers." Now, you might say, "Why trousers?" Well, apparently, once you became converted and baptized, especially if you were a young boy, you were given trousers. And this was a symbol of your conversion in the minds of those Africans that they were converting. And it was also, as we know, a symbol of European civilization. So the trousers had become synonymous with Christianity, because the young people who became Christians became baptized. That's what they wanted. That's what they received. That's what they were to now wear daily to Christian school and to the church. It became a powerful symbol of conversion, almost synonymous with conversion. Language, too, became a measure of conversion. If you gave up your native tongue, which you were very much encouraged to do, then that was also another symbol of becoming a Christian. If you gave up your native customs, such as drumming or any other musical instruments that you found dear, that was another benchmark of conversion. Yet, and this is what I found and saw myself thinking as I looked at these records, I remember the story of Samuel, who was sent by God to anoint a king. And you remember this in 1 Samuel 16, where he goes to Jesse, and Jesse has 7 sons, and he parades every single son before Samuel, and he says, you know, "This should be the king, and this should be the king," and they all are these men of great stature. And Samuel says, "But don't you have any other sons? Because none of these will do." And Jesse finally calls, as you know the story goes, he calls for David, and he is anointed as king by Samuel. 1 Samuel 16:17 says, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him,'" meaning I have refused these other sons. "For the Lord sees not as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." And I think that particular scripture was very much a part of my conversion. Just being reminded that it is not about the outward appearance. It's not about the trousers. It's not about the trappings and the cultural baggage that we all bring, that I bring, that you bring, all of us bring when we are somewhere that we're converting or we're trying to attempt to convert others to Christ. It's not about these outward things, that it really is about the heart. God is concerned primarily with our hearts. All through Scripture, it's about the heart. Even in Romans, when we talk about conversion, it says, if you believe with your heart, confess with your mouth. It's all about the heart. It's not about how we look or what we wear, or the height, our stature, our grandness, our role or position in life. And I think it was sad, and one of the things I learned again and took away from this experience of looking at the German missionaries is that somehow their introduction, as well-intentioned as they were, their introduction of Christianity to this group of Africans that did not know Christ was really almost on a surface level. And it becomes synonymous with these outward things because of the emphasis on these outward things. And I think in many ways God was exposing this. So what was God doing? I think he was exposing, frankly, the fact that if we were not careful, we can present our religion and our faith on a fairly superficial level, and then we cannot be surprised that it will be accepted and received on a superficial level, that there will indeed be a scant harvest. The second thing I found in terms of looking at these records and trying to discern what was God doing was that the whole notion of redeeming these slaves, 150 slaves over a 10-year period, and on one level, this, of course, is a wonderful thing, because for these particular slaves, certainly it is better to be free than to be enslaved, and it was a good thing. But I also found myself, and again, I believe this is some of what the Lord was revealing to me as I was looking at the records, asking myself, had these missionaries thought more about the other things that God could do and would do through them if they were available to being used in that way? For example, they were Europeans. They were part of a worldwide Protestant community, even if they believed in slightly different things from other Protestants. But certainly they had the privilege and the power to approach the powers that be in Europe on behalf of those very same slaves and other Africans who would still be enslaved. Just as soon as one was freed, another one would be enslaved, to end this slave traffic first and foremost. How many things, and if you think about it in contemporary context, how many things can we influence right here at home without ever going anywhere? Because frankly, we have more opportunity, we have more power and influence to talk to the powers that be right here that influence the things over there. And so I found myself just wondering whether indeed they had fully and completely used all the resources that they had at their disposal to really influence the end of slave traffic, much the way the Quakers had in their own small and significant way, and other Christian groups had in at least getting to the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. But again, there was so much more work to be done. And worldwide, Christians were needed on that forefront to really approach their governments, their business people within their own countries, which were very much the engine of slave traffic, to try to end slave traffic. So what was God doing? I think God was saying in many ways that there were more and other opportunities in which they could use their influence. And it made me think about ways in which I had other opportunities, other things that I can do right here from the place that I stand in order to affect change in the places that I care about, whether it be in Africa or in the Caribbean or and so forth. The second example I want to give you is from a more personal example, and it's what also helped me to regain my focus about what God was doing and what he is doing in my life. And the example is about how I have dealt with overcoming the legacy of slavery, just on a personal level. This is a tricky one, and I do often get asked this, and I think quite fairly, and I'm happy to share a little bit of the journey. I can't say as much as it would take. It would take a long time to explain the personal journey that I've gone through as a person of color, who considers myself both Jamaican as well as American. And so I relate to the experience and the legacy of slavery in both places. And obviously, having done this research in Africa, I have a strong connection to the suffering and the pain that was experienced there and the legacy that's left there, not just of slavery, but of colonialism that followed. So how did I and how am I working through and overcoming this legacy of slavery? Let me just use as an example right here now the other book that I'm working on called The Weeping Time. The Weeping Time is about the largest slave auction in U.S. history. And as I mentioned, it's the largest slave auction in U.S. history. It took place in 1859. 436 men, women, including 30 babies, were sold in Georgia, Savannah, Georgia specifically. All across the South, they were sold. It was a phenomenal event. It was well documented in newspapers and so forth. These people had originally lived in small Butler Island, which is one of the coastal islands off of Georgia, and they originally lived in this place. For a good couple centuries, they had been more or less settled communities. They were not slaves who were typically bought and sold. The typical slave in the American South, or even in the West, because we had them in the West as well, and even up here in the North, even in northern states where I'm from, the typical slave could be sold for at least six times during their lifetime. That was typical. These slaves in Georgia, in this small Georgian island, were not sold very often. And so they got used to being a community. They knew their mother, their fathers, they had wives, husbands. As much as slaves could have these things, there was a sense of community. So when they had to be sold in 1859, because Pierce Butler, who was their owner, was a terrible gambler and gambled away all his money and now had a lot of debt and so had to sell half his property, it was a tragic, tragic time. And they themselves call this time the weeping time. And what I'm doing in this book is tracing this obviously very sad story to how it ends up today. I'm actually documenting the auction itself and looking at where these families went, what their experience was. But I'm also looking at the ways in which they refound and regained their freedom in 1865, and how they went searching for each other all over this country. How even if they set out on foot, whatever they had, whatever clues they had, advertisements they put in churches, in black churches and the rest, whatever they had to do, they did, in some cases, to regain and reconnect with their families. But I give you a sense of the sadness of this just to give you just a snapshot of something that you know a little bit about anyway, which is that the period of slavery was a devastatingly painful time. And the auction, I think, really captures that in a snapshot. How do I deal with this when I'm reading these sources and looking at these sources and looking at what plantation life, even before the auction, was like, particularly for black women who were randomly raped? How do I deal with these things? How do I wrestle with this? And I have to say that I wrestle with it in many different ways. I think God's given me a grace to go through various parts of the journey, to be angry when I was angry, to be fearful and despairing when I was despairing. I think he allowed me the grace to do that within certain boundaries. But he also allowed me, through looking at the records, to understand that he was at work then too. You know, and I want to be careful here because I'm in no way saying that, boy, we're so, you know, slavery was a good thing in any way. But the fact is that it did happen in his permissive will. Maybe not in his divine will, but in his permissive will. So God is always doing something. And I think being a Christian, that really helped me in the healing process of looking at these issues and seeing the sadness, the rawness of them, but understanding that God was at work somehow. So I have to try to find out as much as I can through prayer, through reading the scriptures, through looking at the records, what God might have been doing. And one of the things, and these are the two takeaways that I have that I want to share with you, one of the things that I discovered is that I think God was putting a mirror up to institutionalized Christianity in a really significant way during this time. You know, God is definitely about exposure of sin. You know, we're sometimes not that comfortable with that fact, and we want to think of him all about grace and love, and he is all that too. But there's more grace and more love after he exposes sin. And I think we can all agree that is part of what God does. And so in many ways, I think one of the things God might have been doing during this period of slavery is holding this mirror up to institutionalized Christianity and saying, look how far away from the gospel you are. Because many slave owners, of course, thought of themselves as good Christians. Many a slave ship, it was almost a requirement that most slave ships had a priest or a preacher on board. Never did know what exactly their role was. Were they to bless the crewmen or the slaves? I don't know. But it was just a part of the business of slave trafficking. You know, Christianity gave sanction in so many different ways for a very long time until you started to have those breakaway groups and abolition and the abolition movement and so forth. It gave a lot of sanction to the slave trade early on. And I think God was really exposing during this period just how far away from the gospel message they were. The far away from the message of love, far away from the message of there is no respect of persons, which is the truest message of equality that there is, that exists in the Bible. And the Quakers and other conscience-minded Christians, they had to wrestle with these. They had to wrestle with slavery, and many of them did. And because they did, I think it helped to expose the fact that many who called themselves Christians were actually living on a very nominal level. They were accepting Christianity on a very surface level. And I think that's a lesson for us even for today. The second takeaway I get from this in terms of what God might have been doing during this time, and it helps for me in terms of the process of healing, is that this was a time when God used, when slavery, through slavery, many people of color, many people of African descent, became to embrace Christianity. Now, I want to be very careful here because I spend so much time doing history in Africa, I can tell you with confidence that 1,900 years ago, Ethiopia embraced Christianity without slavery. So, you know, God can do it many different ways. Let's not limit him. But since, as human beings, we turn to this awful means in terms of greed and profit and for our own economic and, in some ways, cultural desires, we turn to these means. God, what we meant for evil, he used for good. Right? Right? He doesn't have to. We could have been introduced to Christianity in a myriad of ways. But since we had done this thing, he brought order out of the chaos that we created. And I'm comforted by that. I don't know about you, but somehow I'm comforted that he makes up for my mistakes, you know, that he doesn't leave me in my mess. And collectively, it's the same thing. So people of color were driven to Christ, literally, out of the hardship and the cruelty of slavery. And there was a book that they wanted to read. You know, reading was completely banned, and it was against the law for anybody to learn to read if you were a slave, of course, completely against the law. But they would sneak. Some slaves would sneak to learn to read and try and beg a kind master or pastor or someone to teach them how to read. And the only book they wanted to read was the Bible. And the rest of them were learning it by heart since they couldn't read. So they were driven to Christ. And obviously, this is a beautiful thing from our perspective of Christians. And one of the books I want to mention here that brought this home to me really significantly is a book called The History of Mary Prince. And it's called The History of Mary Prince, a West Indian Slave. And it was published in 1831. And Mary was a typical slave. She worked from sunup to sundown. She was a washerwoman, and she had persistent rheumatism because she was always bending over. And so whenever she stopped because she was sick, her mistress in particular, not the master in this case, but the mistress, had a fondness for whipping her with a horse whip. And so Mary just got sicker and sicker and progressively had a very, very difficult life. Even when she had other masters, it was a similar situation. But she wrote, in the end, she ended up in England, like other ex-slaves. She got her freedom, and she ended up in England. And she wrote this narrative about her life. And it's such a significant book. It's on the web. It's digitized, and I really encourage you to read it. One of her most famous phrases is, "All slaves want to be free, because to be free is very sweet." This book was a real book for the abolition movement. This book really helped, along with all the other books that were written by both whites and black abolitionists. Wonderful interracial movement. This book really helped to advance the cause of the ending of slavery. But what I loved about it the most were two quick things. One, how she noted in the book that the faith of her mistress, who, yes, was a Christian, a good Christian, she noticed, even from her plight, she noticed that faith was not heartfelt. And she actually shows and shares the fact that she pities her mistress in this book. Now, here is this woman. She is being harassed at every turn. But yet, she, at some moment, she has this consciousness, this almost revelation, that this poor woman, you know, had not come to know the sweet savor and favor of Jesus that she, the slave, knew. That was one thing. The second thing that I noticed is that Mary doesn't somehow see herself as some kind of unsung, victimized heroine. You know, Mary Prince, she really got it. She really got it. Listen to what she says. She says, "At some point, I became aware of my own sins. I used to pray, 'God, I used to pray to God to pardon my sins for Christ's sake and to forgive me for everything I had done amiss. And she says that at several points in the text. And you get the sense that it's really heartfelt, that she got it. Yes, she was oppressed, but she was no less a sinner than her mistress or master or anybody else. All of us have sinned and all of us come short of the glory of God. And I said, this is something else, that if Mary Prince can get it, well, there's hope for Ann Bailey to get it, right? To get the gospel message in its entirety, to desire God to do a work in my heart and not to see myself in the true, there is a victimization that comes not just with slavery, but the legacy of slavery. There is a result which is called racism, both institutionalized and personal. We're still living with systemic racism, notwithstanding the fact that we have a president-elect that is black. We still will have, and we still do live with the legacy of racism in our society, and it's going to be a while before we really chip at it. But Mary Prince's story, to me, really encouraged me to start thinking about ways that we can heal from this legacy, ways that we cannot just see ourselves on either side as either superior or inferior, but start to see the gospel message for what it is and start to continue the work that the abolitionists did, both white and black, to continue the fight to end the legacy of slavery and colonialism once and for all. I want to say one more thing on that since I mentioned Obama and he's the man of the moment. I am in Chicago. Can't come to Chicago and not mention him. Let me just say that though I don't agree with everything, all his stances on every issue, I think I, like many people around the world and probably many of you, was very proud to see what took place in November, just as a symbol of how far we have come. And as someone who loves the legacy of the civil rights movement, clearly to see him in the position that he's in and the position he's about to undertake, to be very excited that there is that opportunity for a person of color. And I'm still excited about that and hope that there's hope ahead, more hope than despair. But I must say that, again, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of colonialism is not over. And I'm hoping that we as Christians see this as an opportunity, don't see it. And I think he would say the same thing, that it's an opportunity for us to help him, you know, to eradicate that legacy once and for all. There's so much more work to be done. Almost 2 million people are in jail right now as we speak. I believe we have the largest prison population in the world, and they are disproportionately brown and black. And there's a reason for that. It's not just that they have committed crimes. We have a justice system which really is almost like a throwback to the days of slavery and Reconstruction in particular, you know. And we've got to look at that. And many good books have been written about some of that, so I won't go into that too much. But I have to say that we've got a lot of work to do. We've made a lot of progress in that same justice system, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And I'm hoping that Christians are going to see that as a part of their charge. Last and not least, because I think I have 1 minute, I see a red button that says stop. And I've been dutifully ignoring it, but I'm not going to ignore it anymore. Thank you for your indulgence, Jeff. The last thing I want to say is that what I've been trying to answer through my work and my own personal journey, what has God been doing? What was he doing in the past, and what is he doing right now? And I just want to end on the note of saying, I want to keep asking that question and encouraging you to ask the question. But let me tell you, sometimes we won't get all the answers. We'll only get partial answers. I think it says in 1 Corinthians 13, we'll know in part. But the last word I want to say on this is, I don't know what you're doing, Lord, all the time. I don't know it fully, but I trust you. I trust you. And I think in these turbulent days, I want to leave us on that note of faith, that maybe we won't get all the answers that we want or even that we think we need, but it does come back to faith and trust. And even when we don't understand, saying, Lord, I trust you. I trust you. Help me to be a part of what you are doing in the most positive way possible. But even when I don't get it, I trust you. Thank you very much.